list. To illustrate this point, Republicans are far more alarmed by a diversifying country. Likewise, white people were and are more likely to support Trump, driven by the anxiety associated with the rapid racial diversification of their country. What, you may ask, do white people and the Republican Party have in common? Well, 80% of Republican voters are white. The consequences of the centrality of race and racism to American politics and the threat of internal war are dire. It was racism that was ultimately responsible for the rise of the Tea Party. A reaction to Obama's racialized presidency, the Tea Party, now the MAGA movement, in turn moved the GOP to the right, eventually setting the stage for Trump. With Trump pushing the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen and many Republicans buying it into, the stage is set for another American war of all against all. They have seen this before. The civil war, as it happens, was set in motion by the refusal of the Democrats to accept Abraham Lincoln as the legitimate winner of the 1860 contest, given his views on slavery. He thought it's morally wrong. But it wasn't the economics of slavery that motivated the South's insistence on maintaining what was known as the peculiar institution. Only 3.2% of white Southern families owned slaves. Clearly, then, the maintenance of slavery as an economic institution carried no value for almost all white Southerners. With economic reasons absent, why were white Southerners willing to fight a war over slavery? The Southern way of life, white supremacy. As part of Southern culture, these people were not ready for forfeit their social dominance relative to the black community. These conditions remain in place as many white people, Republicans, confront the fear that by 2044, they will no longer be in the ethnic majority. They feel the need to take drastic measures to maintain white supremacy. It's all they have ever known. It happened in the 1860s. What's to prevent it from happening now? Look for the next civil war to take place after the 2024 election cycle, when the next wave of violence is likely to emerge. Similar to the original civil war, there's too much at stake for both sides. Then, as now, the threats are existential. In the 19th century, Democrats viewed the newly established Republican Party as a threat to their way of life. Republicans, for their part, saw Southern intransigence on the issue of slavery as a threat to the Union. Today, Republicans, driven by the existential threat of losing their white country, will continue their attack on democracy as a means towards preserving America for real Americans. Democrats, on the other hand, see the MAGAfication of the GOP as an existential threat to liberal democracy. Election-related violence generally takes place when the following four factors are present: a highly competitive election that can shift power, partisan division based on identity, winner takes all, two-party election systems in which political identities are polarized, and an unwillingness to punish violence on the part of the dominant group. All four are present in America now and will be more amplified in 2024. Americans are almost there. White angst over increasing racial diversity makes another Trump candidacy likely pushing them into autocracy. Democrats are having none of that. They will resist going down the slippery slope of autocracy the same way that their 19th century counterparts, the party of Lincoln, refused to let the Confederacy bust up the Union. Likewise, should Democrats prevail in 2024, Republicans will revolt. The January 6th Capitol attack is a forewarning. 10 minutes.
On October 28, Paul Pelosi, the husband of U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was violently assaulted after a break-in at the couple's California home. The Democratic Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives was not at home at the time of the assault.
At approximately 2:27 this morning, San Francisco police officers were dispatched to the residence of Speaker Nancy Pelosi regarding an A-priority well-being check. When the officers arrived on scene, they encountered an adult male and Mr. Pelosi's husband, Paul. Our officers observed Mr. Pelosi and the suspect both holding a hammer. The suspect pulled the hammer away from Mr. Pelosi and violently assaulted him with it. Our officers immediately tackled the suspect, disarmed him, took him into custody, requested emergency backup, and rendered medical aid. The suspect has been identified as 42-year-old David DePepe.
The assault came less than 2 weeks before midterm elections, in which control of the House and the Senate is at stake, raising fears about political violence.
The news reports indicate it was intended to be an attack on the House Nancy Pelosi lives in, the third ranking person in the United States in line to be president. You know, it's reported that the same chant was used by this guy they have in custody that was used on January 6th in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. I'm not making this up. This has been reported. I can't guarantee it. I can tell you what's being reported. The chant was, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" This is despicable. There's no place in America. There's too much violence, political violence, too much hatred.
Donald Trump, who's still the de facto leader of the Republican Party, didn't fully condemn the attack on Paul Pelosi. In an interview on Spanish-language Americano media, he called the attack a terrible thing and then quickly connected it to Republican criticisms of the rising crime in U.S. cities. At the same time, Trump himself is being blamed for fostering a dangerous political climate, not least for insisting on stolen votes in the last presidential election in the country.
I ran twice. I won twice. I did much better the second time than I did the first, getting millions and millions of more votes in 2020 than we did in 2016, and likewise getting more votes than any sitting president in the history of our country, as I said. And now we might just have to do it again. I think you're going to be very happy. I think you'll be very happy.
Americans are now sharply divided along partisan lines over their trust in the federal election system, according to a new Politico Morning Consult poll coming days ahead of midterm elections.
Our biggest threat remains the sick, sinister, and evil people from within our country. But no matter how big or powerful the corrupt radical left Democrats that we are fighting against may be, you must never forget, this nation does not belong to them. This nation belongs to you. This nation belongs to you.
The gulf between the two after the attack highlighted the country's internal political estrangement ahead of the midterm elections.
And I want to take a moment just to say a prayer for a friend of mine, Mr. Paul Pelosi, who was attacked. A politics where some in office or who aspired to office work to stir up division, to make folks as angry and as afraid of one another for their own advantage.
Republicans remained unwilling to upset their voters by being more critical of the extremism running through the GOP base. That's while Democrats were trying to link rising threats against lawmakers and their families with Trump's political movement as spiraling inflation threatens to deal them a heavy defeat at the ballot box.
Inflation is through the roof. You gotta decide between medication and food.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Everything going up, but shit, you can't spend. You go to the store with $10, $20, you ain't come out with one bag. You know, you really can't win.
The Pelosi attack has kindled already fraught debate over the repercussions of political speech, particularly in the wake of last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol.
I did talk with Speaker Pelosi this morning, and this was an act of extreme violence. And I think we're looking at a time in our country where there is so much discourse that is fueled by hate and division. And anyone who professes to be a leader, I think, has to really understand the meaning and the impact of their words and their posture on things like this. I pray for Paul's recovery. I know the Pelosi's, and this is tragic. Somebody literally broke into their home saying, "Where's Nancy?" And I strongly believe that we all, each one of us, have to speak out against hate. We have to speak out against violence, obviously, and speak to our better selves. There is absolutely room, and it is important to have public discourse when there are disagreements about policy. But what we've been seeing recently is so base in terms of reducing it down to something that I think is beneath the dignity and the intelligence of the American people.
While Democratic leaders were quick to condemn the attack, Republican leaders increasingly minimized its severity or turned a blind eye. In some cases, they even made jokes about the assault. For example, Donald Trump Jr. shared an image on social media of a hammer and a pair of underwear with the words, "Got my Paul Pelosi Halloween costume ready." Election denialism, the growth of QAnon and Donald Trump, cult people that love our country, have already divided the American nations. Furthermore, a belief that un-American cadres have captured the government, cultural institutions, and businesses acts to spur Trump's followers and a sizable minority of votes to conclude that dire steps are required.
Sadly, there is a huge influence between the far-right communities and extremist communities such as QAnon to the mainstream politics. We'll just take the example, for instance, what happened after the Mar-a-Lago raid, where Trump was pretty much calling the FBI as the people that is coming after him, that it is just part of a much larger conspiracy theory. And then immediately you saw plots to attack the FBI, and one of them actually was already at the FBI headquarters in Ohio trying to carry out an attack.
The language that Republican officials use show contempt for state authority, including law enforcement, a pervasive distrust of the objective news media, a perception that America is in grave peril, and a growing acceptance of conspiracy theories and white supremacist sentiments.
We know this. January 6th last year wasn't an insurrection. No one has been charged with insurrection. No one has been charged with treason. But it very well may have been a Fedsurrection. We are very concerned that we have sent letter after letter to Attorney General Garland and FBI Director Wray to simply get to the bottom of unexplained circumstances.
My question is this: why is this Congress obsessed with itself and cares nothing about the American people? This is a two-tiered justice system that should never exist in our country, and I'm fed up with it, and so are Americans all over the country.
To add fuel to the fire, Democrats' economic policies have not resulted in tangible benefits, such as helping with medical bills, building new bridges, or trying to keep jobs from going offshore.
This will be, what they're doing right now, the biggest tax hike in the history of our country, the exact opposite of what I did, and they're working feverishly to pile on more regulations at levels never seen before.
A YouGov poll carried out a few months ago indicated over 40% of Americans think civil war is at least somewhat likely within the next decade. And with political violence now rising to the surface, things aren't looking gloomy for the Americans. America's politics is so toxic that it quickly turned the Pelosi attack into the latest vicious partisan fight, even before the full facts are known. Is the U.S. a tinderbox? We'll just have to wait and see.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Analysis of the effects of extreme heat shows that low-income tropical countries have suffered the greatest financial losses. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, climate change has so far cost the global economy trillions of dollars, but low-income countries in tropical regions have borne the brunt of these losses, finds a study that analyzed the economic consequences of heat waves worldwide over a 20-year period. The research, published on October 28 in Science Advances, estimates that the global economy lost between $5 trillion and $29 trillion from 1992 to 2013 as a result of human-driven global warming. But the effect was worse in low-income tropical nations, leading to a 6.7% reduction in their national income on average, whereas high-income countries experienced only a 1.5% average decrease. The study also underlines the need for the introduction of climate policies that addresses environmental injustice. Its findings will support the discussions on loss and damage, which will be a key topic in the United Nations Summit COP27, says Kai Kornhaber, a climate scientist at Columbia University in New York City. The unequal consequences of global warming are something that's been talked about qualitatively before, says Vicky Thompson, a climate scientist at the University of Bristol, UK. But this analysis has managed to really quantify it. It also includes parts of the world that are often excluded from studies on heat waves, owing to a lack of data, she says. To estimate the extreme heat that was caused by greenhouse gas emissions, the researchers combined data on countries' average annual temperatures and the five hottest days of each year from 1992 to 2013 with computational climate models. Days that are very, very hot are one of the most tangible ways that we feel climate change, says co-author Christopher Callahan, a climate modeling researcher at the Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. We know that they destroy crops, they reduce labor productivity, they cause more workplace injuries. Callahan and his colleagues looked at the links between heat waves and economic trends at global and national scales. Their models found that low-income regions that tend to have warm weather suffer the most from increased temperatures, despite their emissions often being much lower than those of wealthy regions. Countries such as Brazil, Venezuela, and Mali were among the worst hit, with per capita gross domestic product, GDP, reduced by around 5% annually compared with what it would have been without human-driven heat waves. By contrast, the GDP reduction in countries such as Canada and Finland is only around 1%. The findings could inform the way in which strategies that help countries to adapt to extreme heat or heavy rainfall are implemented. The fact that we were able to sort of pinpoint this effect of the five hottest days of the year on the whole year as economic effects implies that those few days have really outsized effects, says Callahan. So investments targeted at mitigating the effects of heat extremes in the hottest parts of the year could deliver major economic returns. The study also emphasizes the need for rich countries to pay their share, says Eric Fischer, a climate scientist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, adding, given the unequal burden and the share of historical emissions, the global north needs to support the global south in terms of coping with these adverse effects. Meanwhile, Press TV wrote, the United Nations Secretary General says world leaders face a stark choice to join forces to cut gas emissions or condemn future generations to climate catastrophe, warning that the globe is on a highway to climate hell in the midst of devastating effects of rising temperatures and global warming. Antonio Guterres raised the alarm in the presence of nearly 100 heads of state and government in the two-day COP27 climate summit in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing, global temperatures keep rising, and our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. The UN chief told the summit, adding, we are on a highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator. Guterres said humanity faces a tough choice between working together or collective suicide in the battle against global warming. He said, humanity has a choice, cooperate or perish, calling on richer polluting nations to come to the aid of poorer countries least responsible for the emission of heat-trapping gases. Underlying that climate change could not be put on the back burner, Guterres called for a historic deal between rich emitters and emerging economies that would hold the rise in temperatures to the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial era. The UN Secretary General said the target should be to provide renewable and affordable energy for all, calling on the United States and China in particular to lead the way. Guterres also said it was a moral imperative for richer polluters to help vulnerable countries. The UN chief said rich nations would be expected to set a timetable for the delivery of $100 billion per year to help developing countries green their economies and build resilience against future climate change.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
South Africa has for decades been supporting the self-proclaimed Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in Western Sahara, a move that continues to anger Morocco, which views this region as part of its territory. The South African stance was recently reiterated when the country's President Cyril Ramaphosa hosted Brahim Ghali, the leader of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic.
That is why, as South Africa, we are clear, we are firm, and we are unapologetic in relation to our support for the Sahrawi people.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our show today, we are focusing on South Africa's firm resolve to support the independence struggle of Western Sahara region currently under the control of Morocco. The second segment of our show is on fresh demands by the people of Kenya that Britain must return the head of freedom fighter Koitalel Arap Samoei, which was taken as a war trophy during the battle for Kenya's independence.
South Africa vows to support Western Sahara. President Cyril Ramaphosa has said his country is unapologetic for backing the partially recognized Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, or SADR, in Western Sahara. Ramaphosa made the remarks last month during a visit to Pretoria by Brahim Ghali, head of the Polisario Front and the self-declared Sahrawi Democratic Arab Republic. Morocco annexed the vast resource-rich Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony, in the 1970s. The indigenous population in this territory is firmly opposed to Moroccan control and has been calling for independence from the North African country.
The disputed status of Western Sahara, considered a non-self-governing territory by the United Nations, has pitted Morocco against many African countries that back the pro-independence Polisario Front. Speaking during his recent visit to South Africa, Brahim Ghali, the head of the Polisario Front, urged African leaders to continue supporting the independence of Western Sahara.
The people who suffered like us will appreciate our suffering. And undoubtedly, all peoples of the African continent suffered from colonization, suffered from occupation, suffered from the violation of human rights, suffered from the oppression of the other. Therefore, and objectively, you should be in our side.
Now, to discuss South Africa's unwavering support for the independence of the Western Sahara region, we contacted Tshepo Magama, former member of South African Parliament. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir. Now, why has South Africa decided to take a firm stance in support of Western Sahara at this point in time?
Well, South Africa has always been a strong supporter of Western Sahara and the Polisario Front in particular. You know, we've had very close and warm relations with the Polisario Front when we and the Polisario and indeed the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in the 1970s, were actually cooperating with each other. And so the South African government, and indeed the liberation movement, has had very, very close comradely and allied relations. As a matter of fact, you know, a little known story is that in the 1970s, when the Polisario was fighting against the occupiers in the Western Sahara, in particular Morocco and Mauritania at the time, Morocco was armed by the then apartheid South African government. Upon you know, winning the battles in the deserts of Western Sahara, Polisario actually gave to the ANC, the armed wing of the ANC at the time, Umkhonto we Sizwe, many of the weapons and the vehicles, you know, APCs and other equipment that they had captured in those battles. And so the question of Western Sahara has always been a foreign policy priority for the South African government.
The South African president expressed concern that the world is silent on the self-determination of the people of Western Sahara, while other struggles are highlighted. Let's take a listen.
We are concerned about the silence that persists in the world about the struggle for self-determination of the people of Western Sahara. We find that other struggles are articulated at a higher decibel.
The international community has long backed a referendum to be held to decide the Western Sahara status, but little action is being taken to support the region's self-determination. Morocco rejects any vote in which independence is an option. Many global powers support Morocco's arrogance and are indifferent to the plight of the people of Western Sahara.
The world is indifferent in the same way that the world is indifferent to the suffering of the Palestinian people. You know, in the same way that the world is indifferent to the, you know, more than 70 years of the suffering of the Cuban people and so on. The reality of the situation, as we have seen now with the flare-up of the events in Ukraine, and I mean, many commentators in the West have made it clear that indeed, you know, the Sahrawi, like the Palestinians, you know, like the Cubans, you know, and indeed years ago, like South Africans and all other oppressed peoples, you know, and sanctioned peoples around the world, whether it's Venezuela, you know, whether it's Iran, you know, whether it's Zimbabwe next door to South Africa, we generally do not have blonde and blue eyes. So to put it in their terms, it's very much basic. It's racism.
President Ramaphosa called on Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, also known as the Western Sahara, and the Kingdom of Morocco as member states of the African Union to prepare conditions for a new ceasefire and a just and durable solution to the conflict. Now, will Morocco heed this call?
Well, you know, purely from an analytical point of view, it doesn't seem to be the case, because what essentially Morocco has done, you know, is to repudiate the United Nations, you know, resolutions, and indeed the very agreement, you know, that it, you know, agreed to in setting up, you know, one MONUSCO under the United Nations Security Council, the monitoring mission that was supposed to oversee a referendum in Western Sahara, where people would then decide, you know, on the question of self-determination. What did Morocco do? Morocco, instead of abiding by that, Morocco sought to undermine the United Nations and indeed its own agreement with Polisario by transferring, you know, doing mass transfers or undertaking mass transfers of its own citizens into Western Sahara, so as to engineer, you know, the demographics of the Western Sahara in order to affect the outcome of a referendum that was to be held.
While hosting the Western Sahara leader, President Cyril Ramaphosa reiterated that the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete unless the people of Western Sahara are given the right to self-determination.
Until the people of Western Sahara are able to exercise their own right to self-determination, the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete. As a country whose freedom was attained with the assistance of the international community and international support and solidarity, South Africa stands with the Sahrawi people in their struggle for self-determination. That is why South Africa continues to maintain strong and warm bilateral relations with the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic.
The UN Security Council recently called on the parties to the Western Sahara conflict to resume negotiations to allow for a lasting and mutually acceptable solution, renewing for 1 year the UN mission in the region. The Polisario Front representative to the UN, Sidi Omar, denounced the continued inaction of the Security Council in the face of Morocco's attempts to impose a fait accompli in the occupied territories of the Sahrawi Republic. He also stated that the Polisario Front is committed to the peace process.
We are committed to the peace process and to entering into negotiations, direct negotiations with the Capitan State of Morocco, the other party to this conflict, in line with relevant resolutions of the United Nations and of the African Union.
Now, the Western Sahara issue has been dragging on for decades with no end in sight. In your opinion, what is the solution to this protracted conflict?
The right to self-determination is an intrinsic principle of the UN Charter. The Sahrawi people cannot be denied that right to determine their own future. It might well be that they themselves opt for autonomy within the territorial borders of Morocco, or they might opt for an independent state. But that, as a principle, is the right that they have as a people. And so there are relevant African Union decisions, there are relevant United Nations Security Council decisions. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. The solutions are there. What needs to happen is that the necessary pressure must be brought onto Morocco to abide by its international obligations and indeed, abide by its word to allow for the organizing of the referendum, to cease fire, to end its brutal occupation of Western Sahara, and stop committing these heinous crimes that it routinely, commits against the Sahrawi people.
Well, there you have it. The solution to the Western Sahara conflict is for Morocco to grant the Sahrawis the right to self-determination. I would like to thank our guest, Isetto Magama, as always, for his incisive analysis. Let's now take a sharp break before our next topic, which is on demands by the people of Kenya that Britain must return the head of one of the country's resistant leaders it took during the struggle against colonialism.
Kenyans demand UK's return of resistance leader's head.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Immediately after the death of Queen Elizabeth, members of the Nandi community in Kenya renewed calls to have the British government return the head of freedom fighter Koitalel Arap Samoei, which was forcibly taken during the battle for Kenya's independence.
Now members of his community, and indeed the people of Kenya, are demanding that Britain must return the head of these resistance leaders. Here is one of the descendants of Koitalel speaking about British atrocities during the colonial era.
We are talking about a British government which killed our own people and used built their foundation of their wealth on the blood of our people.
Now, to discuss renewed calls by the people of Kenya that Britain should bring back the head of one of the country's anti-colonial resistant movement leaders, we have contacted Bukengesa, a political analyst. Thanks for your time today. Now, what's your take on the demands by the family and community of Koitalel Arap Samoei that Britain must return his head that was taken to London after his gruesome murder while fighting for the independence of Kenya?
Koitalel Arap Samoei was a leader of a resistance movement against, the British occupation here. And the demand for the Nandi community in Kenya for the return of the head of the Freedom Hero is indeed one of the collective demands that has been put forth to be able to bring out the atrocities that were committed by the British Empire against the innocent Kenyan people. And in fact, the demand for the return of Koitalel's head is only a symbolic, demand in terms of the dignity of our freedom fighters as the Kenyan people.
Koitalel Arap Samoei led an 11-year resistance movement against the building of the colonial railway line through the Nandi area in Kenya. He was shot dead on October 19, 1905, by a British colonial officer who had invited him to negotiate a truce. The deceitful British colonial officer used the invitation as a trick to lure the Nandi leader for the fatal ambush. The brutal colonialists decapitated the body and took the head to London. Britain's gruesome murder of Koitalel Arap Samoei reveals the evil nature of Britain as a regime that cannot be trusted.
I would like to say that the gruesome and the killing murder of Koitalel Arap Samoei also brings out the true character or nature of our former colonizers, the imperialists, that they can never be trusted.
The family of Koitalel Arap Samoei is also demanding a public apology from the British government over colonial era atrocities perpetrated against the Nandi community as well as affected families. Now, their father demanded a total of at least $150 million as compensation for the losses incurred from the confiscated property.
We therefore demand as follows. One, a public apology from the British government to the community and affected families. Two, a total of Kenya shillings, 150 billion, as compensation for the losses incurred from the confiscated property. And three, the immediate return of Koitalel Samoei head stroke skull so that the family and the community can enjoy peace.
Now, do you think Britain will listen to the demands by the people of Kenya for an apology over colonial era crimes and return the head of resistance leader Koitalel Arap Samoei?
What I will say is that everything that the Kenyan people have gotten from the colonial powers has been a product of the struggle. And we do not expect that the British will honor and return the head of the leader of the resistance from the Nandi community in our country. In fact, they will try to find any legal justification not to do it. And even if they were to do it, it will have been forced upon them, either by popular uprising or by a struggle from below by the people.
The Talai and Kipsigis communities in Kenya are also from Koitalel Arab Samoa's Nandi tribe. These communities have taken Britain to court, demanding £168 billion compensation, an apology for crimes linked to the grabbing of their land by Britain for tea growing. There is concern that Britain will frustrate this legal process.
Anything that we have gotten from the British, we have always fought for it. And this court case, we can predict the action of the British leaders at this moment. First of all, they will frustrate the process. Remember, the last case that was won by the Mau Mau freedom fighters was frustrated and dragged in the court for several years. When they lose the moral authority to defend themselves, then they will go back to try and bribe those people who are putting up such cases in court. And if that fails, then the conjecture is to try and now start off a process of negotiations at the back door to try and make sure that the reparations that are paid is as low as nothing.
Over the last 30 years, various cases of Britain's crimes against the people of Kenya have been uncovered. A Kenyan freedom fighter gives a glimpse of how he was tortured during Britain's colonial rule.
At one stage of my life in detention, I was beaten the whole day until I did not feel pain any longer. And then when I was taken back to the camp where I was living, I prayed, God, can you let me die?
There is no doubt that many more crimes were committed, and there is a major cover-up. Activists and lawyers now want the British colonial era atrocities investigated.
The passing away of Her Majesty the Queen presents a wonderful opportunity for the Kenya government to come out even as they congratulate the new king. Come out and request the British government to play their part in bringing an honorable closure to this matter.
Now, our last question. Should countries such as Kenya demand a comprehensive, independent inquiry into crimes and atrocities committed by Britain and other colonial powers during their colonial rule over African countries?
I would like to put it to you that our former colonizers have not just continued to hide the historical facts around colonialism. In fact, there has been a lot of public pressure from the Kenyan masses that the British current authority should declassify all the documents and all the materials during the colonial period. Some of them have been declassified, but the majority of them still remains, you know, unknown to many of the Kenyan people. We have been demanding for declassification of all the documents that relate to the Land Defense Force, that relate to all the assassinations and the murder of the Kenyan leaders of resistance.
While it's quite clear that Britain committed horrendous atrocities against the people of Africa during its colonial rule in the continent, and people are now demanding the truth on these crimes, I'd like to thank our guest, Buka Ngesa, for his insight today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Zionist regime forces continue their attacks against Palestinians. What is disappointing is the inaction from world community and the so-called defenders of human rights. In this regard, we have provided views from world media websites. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Crescent International wrote, "The Zionist occupiers continue their multi-pronged attacks against the Palestinians with the clear aim of trying to crush the spirit of resistance. A clear pattern has emerged. Heavily armed Zionist squatters, euphemistically called settlers, protected by equally heavily armed Israeli regime police, storm Palestinian neighborhoods, farms, villages, towns, as well as the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in East Al-Quds that houses the Qibli Masjid and the Dome of the Rock. If the Palestinians resist, as they have started to do in recent weeks, especially in Jenin and Nablus, the Zionists go berserk and attack the neighborhoods with tanks, armored personnel carriers, as well as dogs. Jenin has been subjected to particularly brutal attacks. On October 14th, Israeli regime forces shot 20-year-old Matin Dabaya when they attacked the Jenin refugee camp. Dr. Abdullah Abutin, 43, rushed to Dabaya's help, This was in front of the Jenin hospital. The Israelis shot him in the head, killing him instantly as he tried to provide medical care to the injured young man. Dabaya died of his wounds. Two Palestinian paramedics and several civilians were also wounded in the Zionist regime barrage of gunfire at the entrance to the hospital. Since the beginning of 2022, the Zionist regime occupation forces have murdered 160 Palestinians, many of them youth. In addition to the Aqsa compound, the first Qibla of Muslims and the third holiest site in Islam, the Zionists have also invaded the Ibrahimi Mosque in Al-Khalil. On October 3rd, a large group of Zionist squatters entered the mosque and played music and danced for several hours, desecrating its sanctity. It needs recalling that on February 25, 1994, a Zionist terrorist, Baruch Goldstein, an illegal alien from Brooklyn, New York, entered the Ibrahimi Mosque in the early morning. It was the month of Ramadan. Muslims were offering Fajr Salat. He shot and killed 29 worshippers, including children, before he was overpowered and clubbed to death. The Zionists have built a shrine to this terrorist. The same day, the Zionist regime army shot and killed 21 other Palestinians in protest over the brutal murders. The total disregard for Palestinian life and sacred places is typical of the Zionist mindset. Zionists are settler colonialists and are fully aware that they have no legitimate claim to Palestine, much less to Al-Quds. Take the case of Itamar Ben-Gvir, a notorious Zionist terrorist who is leader of the neo-Nazi Otzma Yehudit Party in the Israeli Knesset, as known as Parliament. It is a den of racist murderers and thieves. If some people are surprised by the neo-Nazi label used for Ben-Gvir, it shows how successful Zionist propaganda has been in influencing their thinking. For those uninitiated in the politics of the illegitimate Zionist entity, consider this. On the evening of October 13th, Ben-Gvir was seen in a video wielding a pistol in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. He urged Zionist squatters and the police to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones at the occupation forces. On the night of October 12th, the neo-Nazi terrorists threatened to mow down a group of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. The threat should be taken seriously. Last year, the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah gained international attention because of the Israeli regime's indiscriminate land grab and expulsion policies. It is regularly subjected to raids by illegal squatters, including one that occurred on October 14th. Concurrently, the Zionists have intensified their encroachment of the Aqsa compound. Heavily armed squatters, accompanied by the police, barge into the sacred site. Palestinian worshippers are locked up inside the mosque. Those that step out to confront the Zionists are beaten up with batons, rifle butts, tear gassed, or even sprayed with sewage water. Only the Zionists can think of such filthy tactics. Many Palestinians have been shot and killed in and around Masjid al-Aqsa. The Aqsa compound is a special target of the Zionists. It is part of the broader